That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy, here with you for the next hour or so to do one thing and one thing only, and that is to get you better with your money. It's a simple promise, but it's a promise that I will fulfill every single week on this show and have yet to fail on so far. So, shall we take a little bit of a look at what's going to be going on in the show here today? Well, we like to kick things off by taking a little bit of a look at the last week of news, the relevant stuff, not the boring stuff, the things that actually affect the money in your pocket. And then I like to bring in some interesting guests and experts and famous faces to share their own personal advice, their own personal finance stories. And coming up this week, I'm going to be joined by Stuart Mason, the founder and editor at The Car Expert, to talk about, you know, that little thing that a lot of us want to know: financing, leasing, buying outright, which one is the best? And also, we are also going to be joined by Bruce Williamson, the National Press Officer at Rail Future, to explain to me, for some reason, why a one-way flight, no luggage, to anywhere in Europe is cheaper than a train to anywhere outside of London. That's not a fact. Don't fact check me on that one. But I think in like 90% of cases, I'm probably not far off. Anyway, let's kick off with the news. What is going on? What is happening? And what do we need to talk about? Well, the first thing is a little bit of a fraud warning. Rental fraud. I hadn't heard of it either until I read this article, probably because I'm kind of trying to buy a place, so I'm getting myself out of the rental market. But it did make me think. So here's the context. Rental fraud warning has been issued to young adults preparing to move home this spring. Apparently, rental fraud is hugely on the up between 18 to 39 year olds, who account for three quarter of all rental fraud reports. That's 48% for 18 to 29 year olds, and for 30 to 39 year olds, 25% of all rental fraud reports have come from that age range. Now, on the one hand, it makes sense because the younger demographic are going to be the people that are actually in the renting process. The older you start to skew things, the more you're looking at home ownership, which is probably why the most rental fraud claims are coming from young people. But it's also just this idea of preying on young people who are inexperienced, who are going into a rental market potentially for the first time in their lives and are being preyed upon by, well, fraudsters. And why it got me thinking was because I feel like I'm watching all of these videos on social media, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube at the moment, that just describe the rental market in this city and in major cities around the world as being absolutely bloody mental. Like, I think I've seen someone putting in a bid on a flat they didn't even go and view because just the market is just going in that way right now. It's so competitive where you literally have half a second to make a decision. And not just that, you need to go over asking. You need to put down, you know, 1 year up front in order to get this place. And you need to sign off on that without even going for a viewing because it's so competitive. I remember 3 or 4 years ago when I was doing rental viewings, it was pretty chill, you know. You went in, you had a look around, there may have been 2 or 3 other viewings that day. I think eventually you take it away, they call you back a week later, they're like, oh, what did you think? And I was like, yeah, you know, maybe we go for it, maybe it's a bit expensive, put in a cheeky offer just under asking. And you know what? I ended up getting a couple of the places in that exact method. No longer is that the case, especially if you live in somewhere like London. Apparently it's, you know, you can come on a Saturday between 11 and 1. And by the way, we've got 37 other viewings on that day. So if you don't give us an offer that is above asking on that day, you ain't getting that property. I do not know what's going on. How do we deal with this? Well, one way that is a consequence of this entire situation, like I said, is rental fraud. So what is rental fraud? How does it work? And how do you know if you are being preyed upon? I think it's just this idea of people preying on these quick decisions. So rental fraudsters are typically targeting victims by offering, you know, access to properties that basically don't exist. That's the fraudulent part, to make it very clear. They're asking you to come and rent a place that doesn't exist. They might have stolen some images off of Rightmove, which is very easy to do, created a fake listing on an old listing, or just, you know, used a bit of their own intuition to create these listings. they don't exist, or it's not theirs to rent it in the first place. They use fake details, fake photos, or real photos of fake properties. They'll usually ask for offering prices well below the market that incentivize people to kind of take the risk on them because these properties seem too good to be true. And then thereon, you know, you hand them your 1 month deposit. Some of them are literally, this is how bad it is. Some of these fraudsters are asking for 1 month deposit to come and view the property. If you're paying that, just maybe it's not, you're not quite ready to start renting. Let's just put it that way. Go and see the property and see it exists and speak to an actual estate agent before putting down an offer. But they're doing this, and the total amount that reported rental fraud losses amounted to last year was £9 million. Now, that's either a beautiful flat or house in central London that costs £9 million for a 1 month deposit, or in the more likely case, as reported here, that is in nearly 5,000 cases of people being defrauded through rent. Pretty nuts. It's absolutely astounding the kind of risks that people are willing to take at the moment when it comes to the property market. So all I would say to you is, if it seems too good to be true in the world of money, the general advice is it probably is. It probably is too good to be true. So do your due diligence. This isn't a little amount of money you're putting away. When you're locked into even a year's worth of rent, the average price in this country is probably around £1,000 per person, I think. Not in this country, in London right now. It's probably, you know, just under £1,000 per person. That's almost 12, probably plus grand you're spending on somewhere per year. Then you're forgetting about council tax. You're thinking energy bills, electricity, water, all of those kind of good stuff. Wi-Fi, groceries. These are all the kind of costs that you need to start taking on when you move out of home and probably start renting for the first time. Because I'm assuming most renters are coming from home. They're not coming from owning. They're probably going from living at home to renting to hoping to own one day. So just take a second, okay? Don't be pressured. Don't be pressured by estate agents on real listings. Don't be pressured by fraudsters on fake listings. Yes, get your things together. Know the place you're looking for. Know your budget. Know your limit. Know what you're willing to offer. Go look at places quickly, but go there with the full head of knowledge of what you are going into and whether you're able to make that bid straight after. Let's not work towards pressure, people. Pressure is where mistakes happen, and that is clearly what's going on here. So what else is happening? This is a really interesting study about how young women now earn £2,200 more than men as gender pay gap goes into reverse. It's very important for me to kind of preface this entire conversation by saying that being paid different amounts based on your gender to do the same role is illegal. That is outlawed. This isn't exactly what we're talking about. What traditionally you heard is the gender pay gap, which is before, well, what you probably would have guessed I would have said, where women often used to earn less than men. Well, originally it was down to unequal pay. That got outlawed. So that is illegal. If that is still the case, please do report it, because like I said, you can't get paid a different amount for the same job. There are bans. I know that. That's a thing. But specifically, you can't get paid less because of your gender. But a lot of what happens is that because of this history, a lot of male-based roles or male or men in roles rose to higher up positions and therefore creating this inequality. So it comes from the average pay between men and women, not for a specific role. Very important to highlight that. It's kind of taking the whole bucket of society as a whole and looking how a huge amount of men used to take or used to be in a lot of more high paid jobs and women used to be in low paid jobs. This is actually starting to reverse now with young people. So the study took a look at the average age for full-time working women and for full-time working men between the ages of 16 and 24. And it found for women, well, let's start with men, actually. The average salary was £24,283.80. And for women, it was £26,476.40. Over £2,200 between the two amounts, which is a significant amount. And what has happened essentially is that for the past few years, these kind of lines between the average men's salary and the average women's salary have kind of gone up and down, up and down. They crossed over actually back in 2014, which was one of the first times in recent history where the average women's salary In between the ages of 16 and 24, I am describing here, overtook men's. Then it dipped back below. They were kind of dancing around each other. But over the past 3 years, the average male salary has absolutely stagnated, whilst as the average women's salary has shot up from around £23,000 up to £26,474. And this is kind of looking at the reverse of the original gender pay gap in young people. There are a number of other statistics as well that kind of double down on what's been happening in recent years. So, for example, the number of young men versus young women out of work and education, again, this for young, I'm describing as people between the ages of 16 and 24, is 15.1% of men and 11.2% of women. Again, about 5 years ago, the genders were split over, but this gap is now growing larger and larger between men and women. The number of young men versus young women who are in higher unemployment, 3.8% of women and 7.1% of men. And lastly, and I think this is also maybe epitomises a little bit what's going on, the number of young people who are no longer living at their parents' house or who are still living at their parents' house, around 2 to 3% of women at the age of 34 are still living at home. Over 10% of young men at the age of 34 are still living at home. At the age of 24, more than half of young men were living at home still, whereas for women this was around the 45% mark. So this is just kind of showing you what is going on in society. It's a really interesting study put out in the Times newspaper earlier this week, so I would give it a recommend giving it a read, take a look at what is currently going on. Some of it stems back to an idea of this push for equality has actually caused now an inequality that is swinging the other way and widening. It's definitely not wrong that equality was something that needed to be striven for and strived for in the first place, but this is kind of a initial report of a result coming out of it on the other side in 2025. Just an interesting study, and one that I would recommend that you take a read of if you have a second. A lot of good graphs as well that are in there to help explain the issues going on right now. And lastly, one in three people apparently are getting their financial advice from TV programs. Doesn't surprise me whatsoever. I also watch Martin Lewis's show on a weekly basis when it's on, along with apparently 29% of the country that take that as their financial advice. The study has found that 35% of people turn to financial advisors, 30% of people turn to the TV, around 30% of young people turn to their own networks, and 10% of people are now turning to YouTube and social media for their financial advice and tips and education. So I guess I'm part of that. Hopefully I'm leaving a good footprint on you guys. Apparently not as well, because only 26% of people say they trust information they got off social media when it comes to financial stuff. I hope the 26% of you have been watching what I've been doing or listening to this show at the very least. The 74% of you that don't trust what I say, sad. But I guess this is very much a clear indicator of where financial education is going. It's moving away from traditional resources. I say traditional resources, I'm not really sure what they are, to be honest myself, because, I mean, I didn't get educated in school, did you? And they're moving more towards TV and social media. So Martin Lewis, please keep making this country proud. And please keep teaching me and everyone else whatever you can about money, because we clearly need it. Anyway, stick around, because after this, I'm going to be joined by Stuart Mason, the founder and editor at The Car Expert.
Foobar Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
And we've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
But it got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23. And was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yeah. The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes. We could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with. And keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Politics Uncensored.
They can't turn off your water because water is a human right. It's not like internet, which we can talk about.
Are you saying we should all stop paying?
I'm not saying we should all stop paying. I think no one should have to pay.
Their argument would be prices are going up. We need all this money because we have to invest in our ageing Victoria infrastructure, which hasn't, there's been no new infrastructure built in sewage, whatever, since the Victorian era. How would you respond to that?
They're talking out of their backside. It's bullshit of the highest order.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Mr. Later Williams, hello! Mate, can we just address that? You did Strictly Come Dancing.
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair, but listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly, won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got to it, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh, and Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello everyone and welcome back to That Money Show. We are live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy, and joining me now on the show is Stuart, the founder and editor at The Car Expert. And I want to have a little conversation because this is number one, like right up there with the top questions I get asked, which is like, what's the best way to buy a car? But anyway, Stuart, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Afternoon, Gabriel. How are you?
Hi, very excited to have you on here because you know how many people have asked me, like, just tell me, finance, lease, PCP, HP, ABC, EFG. Yep. And I'm just a little bit overwhelmed by the amount of options there are out there to buy a car. So should we start at the beginning? When you're buying a car and these all these options, what are the options? What do they actually mean?
Look, there's, yeah, as you said, there's loads of different ways you can pay for a car. You can either pay cash, depending on how much money you've got in your account. And there are different types of car finance that a dealership will set up for you. The most popular one is what's called a PCP, personal contract purchase, which is a type of mortgage product. So you are borrowing the money. It's a debt, but you don't pay a chunk of it back. You might pay 2/3 of it back, and then the rest of it is kept as a balloon that you either pay off at the end or you give the car back to cancel it. That's the most popular way for people to buy a car privately. You can lease the car, which is basically renting. A lot of people now, if they want an electric car, are going with a salary sacrifice program through their work. There are loads of different ways to buy a car, and there's no one that's better that you'd recommend to everybody. It very much depends on your circumstances, how much money you're looking to spend, what you need the car for, how long you want to keep it, do you want a new car or a used car? Basically, doing your research and working out what you're actually doing and what you need from the car is key to then work out the best way to pay for it.
Surely there's got to be a best way. I mean, you can tell me there isn't, and I will accept that, and I won't push you back anymore. But let's say you're looking for the most financial savvy route. You potentially have the cash to do it, but you might prefer to hold on to that cash and, you know, like we said, do it through a lease or a PCP. Yeah. So you can kind of pay a little bit every single month. Is there a financially more optimal way than other methods, perhaps?
That depends on what your financial goals are. If your goal is to minimize the amount, the overall total cost, then paying cash is normally the best because you're not paying any interest. Mm. The difficulty for most people is most people don't have the cash they need to pay for the car up front. Or what else could they be using that cash for, even if they do have it? So is it the best thing for you to tie up £10,000 or £20,000 or more on a car, or would it be to put a couple of £1,000 in, pay a few £100 a month, and then use the rest of your money for something else. So there is, as I said, there's no best way. It depends on what your priorities are. And for most people these days, it comes down to monthly cash flow. I earn X amount of pounds per month. I've got to spend it on A, B, C, D, E, and F, and I want to put a car in there somewhere. How can I best manage that? And for most people, the best answer tends to be what is the least impactful on their cash flow, so the cheapest monthly payment. But that's not necessarily the best way to buy the car or the cheapest way to buy the car in the long term, but it might be the cheapest per month.
So sometimes making it cheaper per month, like you mentioned, might end up with higher interest payments over that period of time. If you're paying for a car over 4 years versus 6 years, 6 years will be cheaper because it's spread over a longer period of time, but doesn't mean that you're being more effective with your money because you're paying a lot more towards interest over that period of time. And you might be paying a higher interest rate as well. So that's another thing to always consider. So we kind of know the differences between them. We know that it's a very, you know, individualistic decision on which method you go down. Like you mentioned, do you have the cash up front or do you have a little bit or all on your cash flow? Are there any ways for people to figure out their affordability on a vehicle? So for any of these prices, because what I often hear is that you walk into a car showroom, yeah, you've got your eye on this car that you think you might be able to afford or whatever. The car salesman's there, you know, he says, oh, but you haven't looked at this model over here. It's just a little, you'll, for the same monthly payments, I can give it to you. For the same monthly payments, you can have this beautiful upgraded car that you thought was never within your budget. And often what they're doing behind the scenes is just manipulating the numbers to spread out those payments over a longer period of time to effectively make it look the same, but actually end up costing you a whole lot more of money. So are there ways for people to actually know concretely they can afford that car?
The first thing they should do before you even get to a showroom is sit down and look at your budget, your numbers, and what your absolute cannot go any more than maximum number is. Because what happens is as you say, people go into a showroom, they see a shiny thing on the showroom floor and think, oh, I like that. And then the salesman sort of comes up with a number that they think, oh, I can afford that. But they're not necessarily looking at the bigger picture. So, yes, it might be a similar monthly payment, but it's gone for another year or another 2 years compared to what you were originally thinking of. Or it requires an extra £1,000 of deposit up front. And it's really, really important that you know before you set foot in a showroom and even speak to a car salesperson, this is the maximum I can spend. And what a lot of people always forget, and this is really, really crucial, is that it's not just about what the car is going to cost me up front or per month, but it's also what it's going to cost me to keep and run this car. Because they might be showing you a car that you think, oh, I can get this big SUV for the same price as a small hatchback. But that SUV is going to cost you more in fuel. It's going to cost you more in insurance. It's going to cost you more potentially to park. It's going to cost you more in road tax. So it might cost you the same per month in terms of the loan payment, but it might be costing you an extra £50 or £100 a month to run the car. We update running costs every month, every year at the Car Expert. And our latest data says it's about, the average is about £250 a month just to run the average car. So that's not including your car finance payment. And most people forget that bit. And that's without anything going wrong. So £250 a month for fuel, road tax, insurance, all servicing, all those sorts of things. And then if you have any problems or any breakdowns, you're going to be spending on top of that. So it's really important that you don't ever let yourself go beyond your absolute maximum number, because you've also got to factor in it's potentially going to cost you thousands of pounds a year just to keep this car on the road. And people tend to lose that perspective when they get caught up in the shiny thing on the showroom floor and think, oh, I could just upgrade to that model. And it's not necessarily just an extra £10 or £20 a month for the car. It might be an extra £50, £100 a month to keep that car on the road.
Yeah, I think that's a really vital piece of information that, like you mentioned, the monthly running cost of a car has to be part of the equation. I remember seeing an article about two cars that looked fairly similar. I can't remember what they were, but they were saloon cars, nice cars, you know, £40,000. But one literally cost an extra £5,000 a year to run, based on average costs. And these are really easy things to find out these days, right? When you're looking up a car, you can find the average cost of running a specific model quite quickly. Like you said, you update this almost monthly on your website.
We do. We've got sort of average running costs for every new car and most new cars on sale. But again, you can find out a lot of this information very easily. If you want quotes on finance, you can get at least indicative quotes. And if the salesman can beat that in the showroom, then happy days. But you can at least know before you set foot in the showroom, this is what this car should be costing me. And if they can do better than that, fantastic. But if they're not that good, then I know I can get it better elsewhere, because pretty much everything you can buy everywhere, not just in cars, you can get quotes from alternative sources and find out what the best price is for everything. You can find out what the best price for your current car is if you're looking at part exchanging or selling it to a car buying service or selling it privately. You don't just have to put up with whatever the salesman tells you. Oh, I'm sorry, Gabriel, your car's worth 500 quid. You can spend 3 minutes online and find out, actually, no, my car's worth $2,000, not 500 quid.
Yeah.
You can find out, you know, what the interest rates are available on loans for car loans, what leasing rates are available, which cars are the most reliable, least reliable, fuel economy, running costs for different types of cars. All of this information is available. And the more time you spend before you start getting hung up about a particular car, the better off you're likely to be, the more money you're likely to save. And if you work out what you're sort of, I don't know, you're a high-profile radio DJ. You've probably got an hourly salary. That's many times more than most people. But if you work out what you earn per hour, spend an hour doing a bit of research and you'll save yourself enormous amounts of money, more than you would actually earn in that hour. It's absolutely worth your while to look up everything you can before you just bowl into a showroom and get run over by a salesman in a suit with a waving an attractive looking pair of car keys at you.
And with a magic wand, they make the price seem exactly what you wanted it to be in the first place. I mean, what you're describing here is one of the best ways of analysing this problem, which is that there's democratization of information. Everything you need to know exists out there if you just put in a little bit of effort to go and find it. I mean, you can do minimal effort and get yourself even 80% of the knowledge you need, a little bit more to fine-tune all the little, you know, dot the I's, cross the T's on everything you want to know, but it all exists out there. And a car is often the second biggest purchase you're going to make in your life, especially a new vehicle. You look at property, shortly followed by vehicle. These are kind of two of your biggest expenses. And to think to yourself that you're not going to be bothered to spend an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, saving yourself potentially thousands and thousands of pounds. I can't quite see the maths and the logic there. It seems like a no-brainer to spend a little bit of extra time going in well-equipped, because at the end of the day, these people are salesmen. They're not your friend. They're there to make as much money off you as they possibly can and sell to you and make you make a decision right there on the spot using all the tactics they've honed in over a career in that job. And you, the best thing you can do with your weapon is to go in with education and to go in with the ability to just say, no, not interested in that deal. I can move on. I can get it from somewhere else for better.
As you said, these people are paid to sell you a car and to sell you finance and to sell you insurance and so on. So your role as a customer should be to say, okay, right, sell me what you got. And, you know, dance, monkey. But basically, it's your job to do this. So you sell me. This is what I need. You make it fit into my box, not expect me to stretch my box to fit the payment you want. And remember, you always need to remember, it's your money. It's your life. It's your future. And people sort of get very intimidated by car showrooms or big financial expenses. And they feel under pressure that they have to make a decision, and you never do. It's your money. You do what you want with it, and don't sign anything, don't spend a penny of your money until you're perfectly comfortable that you've got what you want, you've got it within the budget that you need it to be, and if it's not right, don't sign. Walk out the showroom door, and even if it's just to go get a coffee, think about it, make sure that you're happy, review all the numbers, and then go back again. But at the end of the day, there are something like, if you looked on Auto Trader right now, there's something like 400,000 cars available for sale. Mm-hmm. The car you want, unless it's something incredibly rare and special, chances are another one's going to pop up today, tomorrow, the next day, that's going to be very, very similar, maybe better, maybe not, but pretty similar. So we're not going to run out of cars anytime soon. If you're not 100% confident, don't sign anything. Make sure that you've got all the answers you need, everything fits in the financial box you need it to do, and then when you're 100% happy and comfortable and relaxed, then you sign off on it and away you go. But the dealer and any kind of salesperson is always going to put pressure on you to sign now. Yeah. Because when people make decisions in haste, they tend not to think through everything they need to think about.
Oh, yes.
And then you're stuck with it for the next 4 or 5 years because you've got a massive finance debt that you can't really get out of without losing a pile more money.
No 14-day returns on your Ford Fiesta, mate. Once you've driven
well,
it. Sometimes, yeah.
Because the finance has a 14-day cooling off period. Any financial agreement has a 14-day cooling off period. It's required by law.
Mm.
But if you walk into a showroom and buy a car, there's no cooling off period on the car. So if you say, oh, I changed my mind, I can't afford this finance, you can cancel the finance. But all that happened, all that means is you then have to pay for the car.
There we go.
You can't give the car back. That, it's something that catches a lot of people out.
That is a brilliant red warning. Well, Stuart, thank you so much for your time, for your advice. And people can check out Car Expert for much more detail.
thecarexpert.co.uk.
Voila. There you go, Stuart. Thank you.
Thanks,
once
Cameron.
Again. Cheers. Well, there you had it. If you are on the cusp of buying a car, Car Expert, thecarexpert.co.uk seems to be the place to go. Anyway, it's time for Money Tip of the Week, my favourite part of the show, aside from a lot of other parts of the show, where I give you one specific thing that you need to know right now that will make you better with your money. And the thing is, we've just started March. That means you are on a bit of a 1 month countdown till the end of your current ISA allowance. It refreshes in the tax year, which is the 5th of April. That is the end of the tax year. And so it is 1 month left to use up as much of your ISA as possible. Now, you don't have to use it, but what these are tax-free places, places where you put your money and you don't pay tax on the interest or the dividends or the gains that you make. You can invest through them. You can save money through them. They act pretty much the same as a normal account, but they have these tax wrappers around them. So to remember, you have a £20,000 per tax year allowance across all of your ISAs combined. On top of that, £9,000 can go into a junior ISA for every child that you have. So that is another ISA allowance, but the money is theirs when they turn 18. Remember, in your £20,000, you can have £4,000 towards a lifetime ISA, which gives you a 25% government bonus up to £1,000 towards your first-time property. These are currently being looked at because they need a little bit of an upgrade. And then within the actual ISAs, aside from lifetime and junior, you've got your stocks and shares, your cash ISA, and one called an innovative finance ISA that if you haven't heard of it, you probably don't need to. Anyway, look into your ISA allowance and use as much of it as you can. Within reason. Anyway, stick around because after this short break, I'm going to be joined by Bruce Williamson, the National Press Officer at Rail Future.
Fubar Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
But it got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23 and was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Politics Uncensored.
They can't turn off your water because water is a human right. It's not like internet, which we can talk about.
Are you saying we
things.
Should all stop paying?
I'm not saying we should all stop paying. I think no one should have to pay.
Their argument would be, Prices are going up. We need all this money because we have to invest in our ageing Victoria infrastructure, which hasn't, there's been no new infrastructure built in sewage, whatever, since the Victorian era. How would you respond to that?
They're talking out of their backside. It's bullshit of the highest order.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Mr. Later Williams, hello! Mate, can we just address that? You did Strictly Come Dancing.
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair, but listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly, it won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh, and Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello everyone and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel Nussbaum. And joining me right now on the show is Bruce Williamson, the National Press Officer at Rail Future, to talk about what on earth is going on with the price of trains at the moment. That is pretty much the entire summary I'm going to give it. Bruce, welcome to That Money Show. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm all the better for not having to afford a rail ticket, so my bank balance is a little healthier right now.
I like it. That's a great intro into the show. And I think let's just dive straight in. Are you able to explain what is going on here? Because it just feels like rail ticket prices keep rising and rising and rising and now are slowly becoming the least affordable method of transport in the country. And I am including flights into that. What's going on? What are the factors?
Yeah, your perception is pretty spot on. And I think we need to understand that it's very much totally in the hands of the government. The fare prices are not set by the rail companies. They never were, really. Even when the railways were first privatised, you know, the government or the Department of Transport or the Office of Road and Rail or whatever organisation is in charge these days sets a cap on fares, and naturally the rail companies go as far as they can up to that cap. Now, what happens now, what has changed, is that the money goes directly to the government. So the train operating companies get the same income, really, regardless of how many passengers they get, and they don't get that money. That goes straight to the government. So why are rail fares going up? Because the government decides that they want to. The government, successive governments, because of course we've got a Labour government now, and we had hoped that there might be a change of heart, but there isn't. It would appear that they feel that the railways require a subsidy and governments don't like spending taxpayers' money. So they say, well, let's squeeze the passenger a bit more every year and put the rail fares up. And it seems that up till now they've got away with it.
I mean, is there logic behind it? They look at the data and they quite literally just look at supply and demand. And they've got a peak price they can choose, but as long as the demand is still there and people keep getting on trains, they have zero incentive to start lowering these prices again.
Yeah, there is evidence, actually, that people have had enough. I mean, I think when it comes particularly to season ticket sales haven't quite picked up, and people are, you know, they look at the price of a season ticket, which often runs well into thousands of pounds, and they think there's got to be an alternative. But, you know, that there is a certain degree of, well, more than a certain degree, a massive amount of hypocrisy on the part of, again, this government and the previous one. It's the same policy that I think for now it's probably the 13th, maybe even the 14th year that fuel duty for motorists has been frozen. And that 5p cut, which was supposed to be temporary, has now become permanent. And, you know, what that does, it makes road transport more attractive and rail transport less attractive, which is the exact opposite of where we want to be going. You know, they're pricing people off the railways and onto the roads. And the price we pay for that is more congestion and more pollution. The government should be doing the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, I could not agree more, right? Get more people onto trains. These things are running anyway. Far more efficient. Far more... what's the word? Better for the planet. green, not necessarily the greenest method of transport, but absolutely by far a better idea than every individual getting into their own car and driving halfway down the motorway every single day. So I can completely see where you're coming from. And it does kind of seem like the logic has just been turned on. Maybe they would change that to turned off at number 10 or whoever is making these decisions. Because like you said, we would love to just have a straight crossover, freeze the rails and charge the cars, because that's the logical way moving forward. I mean, like, let's talk about just how crazy these prices have got right now, because I had a friend send me a picture the other day saying he's from Bristol, wanted to come into London to meet me, and he goes, I could come to London to meet you, but for a third of the price I could be in Paris at the same time, so I'm not so sure if I want to come down to London right now. And is it that bad? Is that what we're talking about now, where a one-way flight, you know, an easy jet to Paris, or not, if potentially even further than that, is more effective than a 1.5-hour train into London?
Absolutely right. Yeah, you see these stories appear in the press from time to time where someone decides that it's actually cheaper to fly via Amsterdam than to take a domestic railway flight in the UK. So there's another issue relating to fuel duty for aviation, which is, I think it's pretty low. Rail, you may not know this, behind the scenes, the railway companies have to pay rail fuel duty. Why? It's just another way of dumping costs onto the railways and making rail travel less and less affordable. It's madness.
It's complete madness. And I told my friend, enjoy your weekend in Paris. Genuinely, you don't need to see me. Honestly, we could FaceTime. That's absolutely fine with me. So let's try and take a look at the source of where this money is going. Is there any indication that these increasing prices or these extremely high prices are used to cover infrastructure upgrades within the rail system to make trains more on time, more efficient? Do we have evidence behind that, at least?
That's what the government will argue. But the point is they've been arguing this for forever, really, haven't they? They say, well, we need to invest to improve services, and we don't see that improvement in services. I mean, yes, there is investment going on the railways. And of course, that's very welcome. But it isn't necessarily tied, you know, it's not hypothecated. They're not saying, well, look, if we put 1% on rail fares, we will rebuild this particular line. So it's all sort of lost in the mire, really. And I think there's an awful lot that still needs to be done to improve the railways to get value for money for passengers.
Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre. And I see what you're saying about this kind of, it all goes into a big pot. And they say what they're hoping or trying to do, but no one actually sees X goes into the pot. It's not like we know exactly X is coming straight back out specifically for railway upgrades. Are there any things that you would want the government to think about, or clear logical steps that can be taken to try and drive prices back down to normality, back to some level of affordability?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it is quite simply a government choice. They set the rail fares. They could choose to freeze rail fares tomorrow. What they do is they use an obsolete measure of inflation called RPI when they calculate rail fares. Now, successive governments and economists have said, look, RPI is obsolete. The much more accurate figure is CPI. Mm-hmm. The governments say it's their preferred measure. They use CPI for almost everything else, but CPI is lower than RPI. So what that means, you know, in real terms, you get not just a rail fare increase, but an inflation-busting rail fare increase. And then they add another 1% on top of that. So they're making railways less affordable. So at the very least, I think they need to limit rail fare increases to CPI. But I'm not holding out much hope, I'm afraid.
Is there anything that the rail companies can do? Or like you said, is this 110% government? Or are there ways that rail companies can cut their profit margins whatsoever?
Well, I mean, obviously it's all being nationalized now, so it's kind of academic. Rail companies obviously were incentivized to put in the lowest bid in order to to win the franchise, and that meant that they cut, for instance, the number of spare drivers they had down to the absolute minimum and cut investment and so on. And that had a result in in a poorer service. You know, that aspect, of course, has now changed. And I do hope that, you know, there were certainly some costs associated with the fragmentation of the railway when it was first privatised, because you had so many different operators dealing with each other and so many subcontractors and what have you. There is scope for a nationalised railway to have some economies of scale and to be more integrated and more efficient. But even if that were to happen, I think what the government would say was, great, we have to spend less on it. They wouldn't put those savings back into rail fare cuts.
Okay, I want to shift gears with you for a second, because right now we are where we are, right? We're not going to be changing the price of a ticket from London to Manchester tomorrow or anything like that in the near specific future. But for the individuals that are a little bit locked into the train, they need to travel by train on a consistent basis or even on a one-off. It doesn't really matter to me. I would love to know what ideas or strategies, tips that people can start to utilise to bring those costs down for themselves, because surely you can be a little bit clever here. There's got to be something you can do as an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll to plug our own organisation, Rail Future, railfuture.org.uk. There's a page on our website with some sort of tips about how you can cut the cost of rail travel. If you're travelling regularly to work, there's not much you can do because those are the sort of the core commuters are the peak fares. Although a season ticket obviously will work out a lot cheaper on a per journey basis, but like I say, you know, you spend several thousand pounds on a season ticket, that hurts. However, if you're making an occasional one-off journey, there are some, you know, really good bargains to be had if you're prepared to book weeks in advance and choose the most the cheapest, you know, advanced fares. Also, there's the issue of split ticketing as well, which can also save you money. So instead of going from Bristol to Birmingham, you buy a ticket from Bristol to Cheltenham and then another ticket from Cheltenham to Birmingham. As long as the train stops there, you don't actually have to get off the train, but there are some substantial savings you can be had, you can get by splitting your ticket that way.
Are there easy ways? I like the split ticketing one, and I'm really glad you mentioned that about not getting off the train, because you had me holding my ticket up, walking off the train, taking one step on the platform, turning around, getting straight back into my seat. But how do people actually find those? Because are they easy to discover, to know that you need to stop in this stop or that stop or the next one on the way, or is it simple as trial and error?
Well, no, it's easier than that. There are websites out there that will do it. So if you type in into your favourite search engine split ticketing railways, that they'll probably come up with a whole load of websites that will show you the cheapest way to do it. So someone's already done the hard work. You know, you don't have to do it by trial and error.
All right, good, because you'd have had me clicking from here to the next stop. Okay, that's that, Brian. I would have had my spreadsheet out on Excel, yeah, down, working out all of the costs to figure out exactly. And knowing me, I probably would have ended up booking two separate trains that wasn't the same one. But that's a story for another day, and we'll go down that route. You mentioned a few things about booking far in advance, booking certain times, peak versus non-peak. How far in advance are we talking here to kind of start to see the real benefits? Is it a week? Is it 2 weeks? Or are we talking months ahead?
I think it's as much as 2 months, because wow, obviously as the seats start to get booked, then the prices tend to go up. So get in as early as you can, I think, is the answer. I mean, you know, obviously that's not so convenient to book a specific train for 2 months in advance. But if you know you're going on holiday or going to visit a relative, then yeah, it can work out really cheap.
All right. So it is be prepared, travel off peak, look into split ticketing. And otherwise, just at the end of the day, it's just getting a car because it's probably cheaper, but not so good for the planet. So if you can travel by train, still do it. But yeah, it does kind of seem like we're stuck in this, you know, period of time, yeah, where trains are not going to be the affordable method of transport unless someone at Number 10 or in the Houses of Parliament changes their mind. Any other glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel for you?
Well, I think it's up to us, the travelling public, to put pressure on the politicians. And I think it's something that the motoring lobby has been very successful at, you know, and that's why the government doesn't dare allow fuel duty rise. But as rail passengers, we've got to put pressure on our MPs and make some noise as well. And maybe, just maybe, the politicians might start to listen to us.
Maybe. There we go. All right, Bruce. Well, thank you very much for coming down. Bruce, the National Press Officer at Rail Futures. Have a lovely day.
Cheers.
All right. Well, there we go. Everything that you've possibly ever needed to know about how to save money on trains. Split ticketing? How have I never heard of this before? Am I the only one? Anyway, time for some audience questions. You guys get the chance to write into us every single week just by DMing us on Instagram under the handle @thatmoneyshow. It makes sense. That's the name of the show, That Money Show. So the handle, exactly the same. And if you write in, we like to answer. And we try to answer as many of your questions every single week. So I'm going to kick straight off with Sam, who has asked, how do I know if I'm putting too much into savings? My friends always tell me I save way too much and leave no money for socialising. Sam, firstly, well done for being part of the quiet minority who are actually saving. And at the end of the day, saving is kind of up to you. Now, there are certain amounts. If you can save, you know, 10 to 20% of your salary every single month, that is a really strong starting point. If you're pushing well beyond that, the decisions, and you're comfortable at 10 to 20%, the decision kind of starts to lean onto your own preference. Now, you could be just someone that believes in, for example, the FIRE movement, which is financial independence, retire early, where all you really want to do is save as hard as you can. We're talking situations where people save upwards of 70% of their salary over a short period of time to be able to retire as young as possible. And you would ask them, how do they know if they're putting too much into their savings? They would say they're not, because they want to put in 100%. But if you're just looking for a balanced approach because your friends are starting to tell you that, you know, you don't seem to have any time or money for them, what I would say is, number one, don't be pressured into finances and friendship. So if your friends are spending a lot of money and all you can't manage to keep up, and you don't think that you could keep up your same savings habits, stuff like that, just tell them that you don't have the same affordability as them at this point in time. However, if they think that you're just going too hard into the saving, and you might say, okay, I think they're right. What I like to tell people is, have a pot of money allocated towards having fun, towards zero level of responsibility, towards literally just, it could be put in the bin and that is your decision at the end of the day. I would call it a fun pot money. You can split money into pots on so many different apps these days, but just put a little bit of money aside and that money can be spent on whatever you want. Clothes, friends, drinks, cinema, food, whatever it is. And you will feel zero guilt around it. And that will allow you to both save money responsibly, but also have your budget for spending irresponsibly. Because at the end of the day, what is the fun of making money if you can't spend a little bit of it as well? That's just my opinion. That's what I do personally. And that's kind of how I figure out how much money I have for socializing, having fun and going out. And it's a nice way to have a balanced approach to life. But at the end of the day, how do you know if you're saving too much? It's not a bad problem to have. Genuinely, it's not a bad problem to have. Harry, what have you got for me? You have said, how important is a rainy day fund? Should it be my main savings account? So, Harry, what you are speaking about, this rainy day fund, is often what people refer to as an emergency fund. So it's essentially a pot of money put aside for the worst case scenarios. If your car breaks down unexpectedly, your dishwasher breaks down, your boiler breaks down, you lose your job and you need to live off something for a short period of time. Life, unfortunately, is filled with unexpected things. Literally today, my washing machine's broken down. Your washing machine is bound to break down at some point. Like, it's just not gonna, if you have a 50-year-old washing machine, like, round of applause to you, because I'm not even sure if washing machines have existed in their current format for 50 years. That's a history lesson for me for another day. But essentially, life is expensive and you need to have this pot of money on the side. Normally, it is said to have 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses. So count or cost up how much it actually costs you to live on a monthly basis. Start by putting £1,000 in this pot and then 3 to 6 months. So that is how important it is. It is vital, because what you don't want to do is have to go into debt or dip into future savings accounts in order to fund these emergencies. You want to have an allocated pot of money there. It's also hugely important, not just from a financial perspective, but from a psychological perspective. So to think to yourself that you never have to worry, because if something goes wrong, you know you've got it covered. You know there's a pot of money that can cover that kind of stuff. It will just make you so much more confident to be adventurous with the rest of your money in terms of trying to maximize its returns and do things with it. Your last question is, should it be my main savings account? No, it should have a limit on it. It's 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses. If you are hate risk, or if you need a little bit more cover, some people go up to 12 months or 2 years if they, let's say, they're self-employed. Or the other way, people who live at home and have no risks in life will go down to 1 month. It's up to you. But once you have that set aside, you can start putting other savings towards short-term savings, things less than 5 years, and long-term savings, things that are more than 5, 10 years, etc., etc. So it's not your main savings, but it's a very important fund. Anyway, that's all we have time for today. So thank you so much for listening to the show. Remember, you can download the FUBAR Radio app if you want to and listen to us live every single week. You can find us on Instagram at That Money Show. You can find us on every podcasting platform if you want to listen back or you missed part of the episode. And thank you to Stuart, and also Bruce for coming on the show. I have been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show, and as promised about an hour ago, you're now better with your money.
FUBAR Radio.